The following podcast contains some graphic descriptions of child abuse and may be difficult to listen to. Please take care as you listen. The church should be a place of healing and comfort, but for too many, it's a place where they were abused and harmed. Ryan George is one of those. He was profoundly hurt in his childhood church by his father, a fundamentalist pastor. But in this hope-filled podcast, you'll hear Ryan's redemptive story of being not just hurt by the church, but healed by it as well. Welcome to The Roys Report, a podcast dedicated to reporting the truth and restoring the church. I'm Julie Roys, and I'm so excited to bring you this podcast with Ryan George, author of a new book called Hurt and Healed by the Church. This is such a redemptive story, exposing both the worst and the best that the church can be. Ryan grew up the son of a pastor in an independent, fundamental Baptist church. And though Ryan's dad would preach about love and forgiveness, he physically, verbally, and spiritually abused Ryan. And as Ryan would find out when he left his father's home, his father also sexually molested girls. This left deep wounds in Ryan and profoundly distorted his view of God and the church. But then he decided to break from his fundamentalist background, and he began attending a church that was nothing like the churches he had known. At this church, the leaders welcomed questions and invited people to experience Jesus, not just obey his rules. In this church, Ryan developed a relationship with Jesus that he never knew was possible, and he began to heal. I love Ryan's story, and I think you will too, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this podcast, Judson University and Marquardt of Barrington. Judson University is a top-ranked Christian university providing a caring community and an excellent college experience. Plus, the school offers more than 60 majors, great leadership opportunities, and strong financial aid. Judson University is shaping lives that shape the world. For more information, just go to judsonu.edu. Also, if you're looking for a quality new or used car, I highly recommend my friends at Marquardt of Barrington. Marquardt is a Buick GMC dealership where you can expect honesty, integrity, and transparency. That's because the owners there, Dan and Kurt Marquardt, are men of character. That's because the owners there, Dan and Kurt Marquardt, are men of integrity. To check them out, just go to buyacar123.com. Well, again, joining me is Ryan George, author of the book Hurt and Healed by the Church. He also blogs at explorience.org. And he co-founded and co-leads the Dude Group, something Ryan calls a spiritual adventure community. So, Ryan, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm stoked to be here. Thanks for having me.
I just loved your book.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, I loved it so much that it's our premium for this month. And that means if people give, if they donate to the Roys Report, give $30 or more, we'll send them a copy of your book, which you have so graciously supplied to us. So thank you. And if you want to do that, folks, you just go to JulieRoys, spelled ROYS.com/donate. Again, that's JulieRoys.com/donate. And Ryan, I have to say, your book is the first book that I have read where the author mentions that they have donated to the Roys Report.
I was trying to send people your way.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that so much. But you're also a monthly donor, and that is just huge to us. Actually, 60% of our support comes from monthly donors. And so I just thank you. It's those small donors. You know, I think our average is probably around $25, $30 maybe a month, but that means that's our backbone. So I just want to thank you. And thanks for the mention. Boy, that was great.
You're welcome. I probably should have told you first, but I printed it anyway.
No, it's great. Yeah, you're not going to get an argument for me for putting a plug in, you know, your book for us. I love it. But I think what was so, what I love so much about your book was that you not only talk about the really tough stuff, which is, you know, the pain, the abuse, everything that happened in your childhood as being part of a church where your dad was a pastor. And, you know, I know listening right now, there's people that are probably at all different levels of, you know, reconstructing, deconstructing. Some are just trying to hang on. And so what I loved is that there was hope in your book because, you know, you've kind of come through this really, really awful thing. And yet your faith is intact and you found something really beautiful. So, I mean, I'm excited to dig into that, even though we're going to have to start with the tough stuff, which is what, that's where you dive in with your book, is the abuse that you received at your father's hands, your dad being a pastor in an independent fundamental Baptist church, IFB church. Tell me what it was like growing up in your home.
Yes, it was interesting because my faith and my home were similar in that in church life, we approached God very superstitiously. The whole point was to keep God happy and to make God happy so he wouldn't judge us. Mm. And in an abusive home, that dynamic is very similar, right? It's what do I have to do to keep dad from being angry? Mm. And there were different things. Most of the time, things that I would get in trouble for were talking back, like giving feedback, like, hey, I don't agree with this, or this isn't right, or whatever. But yeah, it was a dangerous place. My dad hung me. My dad froze me in minus 32 degree weather. He choked me, threw me through a wall. He threatened to knock my teeth out on a regular basis. I wouldn't say often, but two or three times growing up, he would say, hey, you know, the children in the Old Testament, when they disobeyed or dishonored their parents, they were stoned to death. So you're fortunate to even be alive right now. And so that's the underlying message. You know, before I left for college, he got up on top of me, red face, inches off my nose, and said, you're going to hell. And I pray every Sunday, you know, and this was in a church where I served four services a week. I tithed my paychecks to my own dad. Like it was a place, it was all I knew. I was faithful. I was an usher, a greeter, did all the right things, you know, quote unquote, but because I didn't like being homeschooled and because of other policies in our home, I didn't care for and voice my objection, that doomed me to hell.
Hmm. Did you receive that message, or were you just kind of confused, or did you live in fear? I mean, how do you, as a kid, how do you deal with something like that?
It was unnerving because I didn't have that relationship with my dad until I was almost his height. You know, like I have stories in the book of how loving and generous and whatever I experienced my dad up until about middle school and high school. It was the verbal stuff that he did not want to contend with. I was mostly an obedient child. I followed the rules. I didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't look at porn, didn't have sex with girls, like, or guys, anybody. But like, it was strange to me to reconcile that with how did I deserve this? You know, there were times I ran because I got scared. I ran away from home three times. One time I almost got shot because my buddy didn't realize that I wasn't a home invader. I walked to his house 12 miles for safety in the dark. Wow. And when I got there, he's like, man, it's so good. I realized who you were. Cause I was ready to go. And, there was moments like that. I would just run until things calmed down and my parents would send someone to come get me or come get me themselves. So in some ways when I left for a very extreme college, a fundamentalist college, it was so much safer for me and I could let my guard down. Mm. And even though I wasn't one of the cool kids, I was far more comfortable there because no one was coming for me.
Wow. And it is interesting. As an adult, you would think you would just go in the opposite direction. A lot of people do that. You know, when they grow up in a home like that, they've had it. And when they get out, it's just, you know, they go almost as hard away from God as their parents had tried to force them to go towards him, although kind of a weird kind of perverse image of God that you were given. But when you got out, you went to an IFB college. When you graduated from that college, you got married and you went to an IFB church.
Yeah.
What made you keep going and staying in this tradition, even though it had been so painful and hurtful to you?
I did not know that how my dad was systemic in that tradition, to be one. The other is, if that's the only way, so from the age of four until I, you know, left home, that is the only way God was presented to me. It was the only, and it was presented to me as like longtime orthodoxy. And fundamentalism is only about 100, 110 years old. So it's really not that long, but it was presented to us as like, this is the way that it's always been. And so because it was all the abuse, all the weird stuff in fundamentalist culture was wrapped around, well, this is how you approach God. I didn't want to lose God. Like I was so superstitious that it took 2-3 years of marriage before I was willing to leave the cult.
And you had a horrible discovery in your adulthood that your father's abuse wasn't just physical and verbal and spiritual, but it was sexual as well. how did you discover that and deal with that?
Yeah, so dealing has been a long process, and discovering has been a long process. The first clue we got was in the 90s. I was going door-to-door visitation with my mom, and we would walk up to people's homes and say, hey, do you have a faith? Do you have a church? We'd love to invite you to ours. And a stranger that neither my mom nor I had ever met said, oh, I would never go to your church because the pastor over there is having an affair. And my mom's like, I don't think you have the right church. And she corroborated and she said, yeah, that's the, and she named my dad. And my mom said, you don't, that's my husband. You, and the lady said, well, ma'am, you don't know your own husband. And that didn't make any sense to me. Wow. Like, we just thought that was so weird and kept going, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I was married maybe a year and a half. And my dad gave me a phone call. We lived out in the Midwest for a season. And he said, hey, I cheated on your mom with a teenager. And that's how he had described it. And we would find out 20 years later, one, it wasn't consensual. Two, it didn't start when she was of legal age. But then 10 years after that, so my wife is the missions director of our church. She's bilingual. She's a missionary kid. Mm-hmm. And we take women down to work in basically almost like a rescue operation for people mm-hmm. who've been trafficked. And we take counselors down. And we also take people who have had sexual trauma in the States who would have a lot of empathy down to these women to say, hey, this happens more than just in your context. It even happens mm-hmm. in rich America or whatever. Well, in one of the meetings for one of those trips, one of my dad's other victims is like, yeah, I relate to this because of Ryan's dad. And so I learned about it because my pastor and my wife came to me and said, hey, this came out in a meeting. And then 6 years after that, we were visiting my parents. There's a whole bunch of people at my parents' house. And my wife was painting in the living room and she pulled her earbuds. She's like, what in the world? She heard my dad talking to middle school girls about how the women in Song of Solomon were praised for their body parts. And so Crystal reported it to the parents of these girls, but they didn't know all the other stuff that we knew. Then that didn't match what they knew. So it never went beyond that because for them, that was a one-off instance. And then several years after that, which was 2021, Chris and I come home from vacation and there's a 2-hour long podcast with one of my dad's victims with receipts. And it goes all the way back to the 90s, back to when we heard the lady door-to-door visitation. And the damning thing there was, is when they told my mom, so this is before the other victims that we know about, my mom said, oh, not again. And so then it started to cast shadows on why did we move around so much when my dad was an assistant pastor. There was one church we left in Pennsylvania, and my mom and dad were half of the school's four teachers for their Christian school. And we just up and left in the middle of a November school day. And the church paid my dad for like a year, year and a half to get a church started out of state, which now looks like going away money, make the problem disappear money type of thing. We don't know.
And this just drives me crazy. I mean, this is what drives me insane, that they knew he was an abuser, or at least they must have had a strong indication to pay him a year, year and a half. Obviously, they had a deal. At least it sounds like they had a deal.
It sounds, yeah.
To keep it quiet. And they seriously, do they not get that there's never a one-time offender? Like, that just like almost never happens, that it's like that they're passing on an abuser to another church. It's just mind numbing.
Yeah. I don't know how you can say that you love the body of Christ when you send that type of danger to another part of the body of Christ. Like it's like, well, at least it's not my kids. It's not my daughters. You know, that's such a myopic view of the world and of your church.
Yeah. And didn't they say in the podcast, and this is so awful, I can only imagine, like you're dealing with hearing this about your dad, but they assumed that you knew, you know, back when it was happening, and you immediately, like, you got in contact with this gal through Facebook or something and said, man, I didn't know, and I want to know how to help you. And, you know, and then you connected and you were able to help her, weren't you?
I tried. You know, she said, are you willing to talk to my attorney? I said, yeah, I'm willing to answer any questions. And he gave me a barrage of questions, and I gave him as many receipts as I had. At the end of the phone call, the attorney said, man, I got to tell you, your dad was incredibly slick. Like, it's as if he knew this day was coming. And so we started in 2012 recording conversations with my dad, and they don't match up. And he admits to some things on some recordings and not on others. But I had to let her know that, like, I'm embarrassed that I didn't pick up on it, and say, hey, my dad said it was an affair. I live three states away at the time. I was married. I didn't know any of this was going, and I'm horrible for this. I feel horrible, but I'm willing to work with law enforcement, attorneys, whatever. Please know, like, I am for you. I've reported two sex offenders in my adult life in our church, mm-hmm. people who've come through our ministry. My wife's reported two in ministries that she's been involved in. Like, we are for justice, and we are for you. And I'd love to help you any way I can. It was a limit of, I didn't have any record of this.
But you did help a woman actually come forward with her story mm-hmm. About your dad as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So the one that went to our church here in Virginia, yeah. She had moved down here. In fact, Crystal and I had tried to help her out when she moved down here, mm-hmm. Getting her started on her feet. And I was so honored because she said, hey, I want to go talk to your dad. Will you go with me? And to be trusted with that.
That's amazing that she wanted to talk to her abuser. I mean, that can be extraordinarily traumatic. I mean, that's surprising in a way. But yeah, keep going.
If you make someone feel safe and if you honor their story, right, and they know you're for them. So it's really interesting. Like, even as the son of her abuser, she'd seen the opposite in my life. And I hope everyone always sees the opposite in my life, right? Like, that's what I'm living for. Is last night in our Bible study, we were studying about how Jesus took a young child and put in his arms and said, be like one of these. And we went around the fire like, hey, what stood out to you? And I was like, everybody felt safe in Jesus's arms or within 18 inches of him. You know, even his enemies, he put his ear back on of the enemy. And I want to be that safe place. And so I consider, a great accomplishment that even my dad's victims would feel safe with me.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big deal. So you would think that as the truth begins to come out, the rest of your family members would feel likewise. But that's not really been the case, has it? It's kind of been a mixed bag for you, which makes it, I would think, pretty traumatic for you trying to do the right thing. And then this is what the response is.
Yeah, I have to give a lot of grace for my siblings, because they didn't have the experiences I did. I'm significantly older than most of my siblings. My parents had us in two big batches, and I was in the first batch. And so they didn't know, like, they weren't there when that woman said door to door to my mom, your husband's had an affair. They just didn't have categories for it. They hadn't spent, by the time they found out on the podcast and the year before that, when I went with the one victim to tell her family and then to tell mine, like, that was brand new to them. And I thought, well, how long did it take me to process this? I was still hanging out with my dad after I first learned for a while, because I couldn't figure out, like, how do I navigate this relationship? Mm. How do I do boundaries? And so that allowed me to extend grace to my siblings and other people in my family who are like, we're still going to be cool with them because we think God forgives, right? One of the things my dad used to do in front of his victims was, right after he would assault them, he would pray in front of them aloud, asking God for forgiveness. And then he would turn to the victim and he would say, see, I just got forgiveness for God, so you don't need to tell anyone, because now it'd only be gossip. Well, it's gross, right?
Yeah, it's really gross.
And that same thing went through my family, because some people were like, well, we need to forgive. He said he's sorry. I was like, well, he hasn't confessed to authorities. He hasn't confessed to his pastor. He hasn't confessed to any mentors. He hasn't got any recovery groups. He's not in, SA or anything like this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how repentant that is. I think he got caught, and he admitted he got caught. And so over time, actually, the positions of my family, different members of my family, have changed as they've wrestled with it and gone, you know what? No, he's not changed his mind. He's not changed his story. He's still saying it's the victims are lying, all the different things. And whether it was appropriate or not, me recording all these conversations and then putting them up on Dropbox and saying to my siblings, hey, if you want to listen to them, they're right here. You can hear. And so now, more of us are on the same page, but it's still not even, right? And I get it, because it took me a long time before I could get to the boundaries that I have now.
And it's such a shocking realization. I mean, I can't even fathom. I had great parents, so I have nothing to complain about. But if somebody said something awful about my parent, that would just be, it would. Now, again, you probably had a little different view, having been abused by your own father, but it's still, I just can't imagine how that rocks your world to hear something like that about your own father.
Well, and so I was framed as the problem child. I was the only child that my dad physically and verbally abused. So it was your fault. Yeah, yeah. It was you're the black sheep or your wife's a problem. That was a common thread for a while. And so it was almost like, well, Ryan deserved it. In fact, so the day we adopted our daughter was right after we found out all this stuff about my dad. And I wrote a post about why I was scared to be a dad, but what God has been redeeming in my life through becoming a dad. And when my mom read the blog post, which I tried to write with grace and understanding, I didn't name names. My mom told my sister three times, Ryan deserved all the abuse he's gotten because he's telling his story now. So it's almost like he was pre-abused for coming forward, you know, 20 years, 25, 30 years later. And so like, yeah, it's all over the map with my family, but, I've had to give grace to my siblings, to my mom, to aunts and uncles, whatever, that haven't seen and heard what I've seen and haven't been in those moments with the victims to go, no, I've looked into their eyes. This is real. They're not making this up.
And the spiritual abuse, I mean, it messes with your head. It really does. And so that admonition not to gossip, not to slander. I mean, this is, you know, classic. We've said this so many times, but it's like they all are reading this from the same playbook. They all do the same things. I mean, but it's if you're in it and you've grown up in it, it works. It keeps people silent.
And it's exacerbated even more because of the IFB movement, because in that movement, I likened it in the book to the guy who pulls a stone out of Arthur pulling the sword out of the rock, is that guy in every one of these IFB churches is unassailable. There are no elders. Yeah. There are no women allowed to say anything. Like, and so my dad already had this aura around him. Like he would call out from the pulpit talking about Elisha and the bears, you know, the time when people were making fun of him and he called down the bears to maul him. He's like, don't touch God's anointing. He from the pulpit would tell people, don't mess with me. And so when that's your shaman, when that's your, you know, prophet or whatever you want to, from whatever religion you want to pull from, you're afraid to get on that guy's bad side. You know, he's the rainmaker. He's the king.
Yeah. And just for anybody listening, if your pastor is doing that stuff and saying he is, you can't question his authority, that he's untouchable, that's unbiblical. Mm-hmm. Everyone should be held accountable. The Apostle Paul, you know, the Bereans went home to see if what he was saying was true. I mean, if the Apostle Paul can be questioned by people, then your pastor can too. And that's a huge red flag if your pastor is saying these things. But this is standard for a lot of abusive churches. Although you got to the point where you called this a cult, and IFB is something where, you know, I've been hearing more and more in my reporting about IFB churches. The Duggars came from an IFB church. Shiny Happy People, that's about the Bill Gothard movement, but it also, Bill Gothard was huge in the IFB movement, and we know, I mean, I guess I have to say allegedly he assaulted women because he's never gone to jail for it. But there are a lot of, I think, credible accusations against him. And if you see Shiny Happy People, it'll just tear your heart out. I mean, it's just so, so hard to watch that documentary about the abuse, not just sexual, but the spiritual abuse that went on in these churches. But for you, how did you get to the point where you were like, you know, this isn't just an abusive church or just a bad, you know, one-off church. This is a cult.
Part of it was getting into therapy really helped. So I've logged over 200 hours of therapy. Mm-hmm. One was I became a nonfiction voracious reader. I started reading 40 to 60 nonfiction books a year, particularly outside of my faith. Counseling books and trauma books and therapy books and whatever. And then the other part of it was the more and more that my current faith communities looked like the life around Jesus, you know, the real one, the Jesus who was so safe that women felt safe to cry publicly on his feet, right? Mm-hmm. Or to curl up next to him and let him teach and for Mary or whatever. There was all these very intimate encounters with children, with men, with different ends of different spectrums, the rich and the poor, the religious, the non-religious, the male and female, whatever. And went, that Jesus, I'm experiencing more and more and more of that Jesus. So what I had before couldn't have been real. There had to be. And so as I started to investigate it through Bible studies, through conversations with mentors, whatever, I just was like, whatever that was, it wasn't right. Now, getting to the place of calling it a cult took a lot of reading and studying and seeing what people who come out of other cults from other faiths, or even like there's so many cults in our culture that aren't even tied to a religion, right? And going, oh yeah, all of those markers were happening in the environments that, and not just in my church, in my college, in my Christian school, in our homeschool curriculum, the different Christian radio voices that we listened to and didn't, you know, all those intentional choices showed, oh, this was groomed. This was intentional so that we would only get one version of Christianity. And going, once you get outside of that, there are times, Julie, where I'd be telling a story to a friend at church and they're like, wait, what? You did, your dad did, you got, like, for instance, at my college before 7 a.m. or 7:30 a.m., I wasn't allowed to walk on the same sidewalk as a girl. Like
before 7 a.m., but it was okay afterwards.
Right. We had to use different stairwells. I was never allowed to swim at the same time as a girl, even at camp. Like we'd have transition times in between so that if a girl accidentally her towel fell off going back to her cabin, we wouldn't accident. And what's wild is they do all these extreme things around gender and sexuality. And then they're doing what they're doing behind closed doors rampantly all over the place. Like it's more rule than exception in fundamentalist churches.
It used to be, at least when I was growing up, that a cult, to call it a cult, it had to have some sort of heresy or errant doctrine as a part of it. And it seems like there's been really a move among experts that, hey, this can have, at least on paper, pretty orthodox doctrine, yet not orthodox in its practice. So the orthopraxy is way off, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a high level of control. Like everything's about control and control over things that bleed into like a person's own, you know, like these are like natural boundaries that human beings should be able to make these kind of decisions for themselves, you know, about what clothes they wear, you know, within reason.
Well, I mean, my sisters were told by different authorities that they couldn't use tampons, that they could only use pads. Right. There are IFB pastors out there that say that your daughters can only have closed toe shoes, not open toed shoes, because open toed shoes show skin. I mean, the granular level of it. But to the orthodoxy part, so they believe, yes, they believe the word of God is inerrant, or whatever ones you want to put down, Jesus rose from the dead, whatever. But it's the emphasis. Right. So many of the core fundamental beliefs. Because fundamentals should be the fewest, right? Which is ironic, because fundamentals actually have more.
It's the fundamentals of the faith, right? Yes.
But like, I still believe Jesus rose from the dead. I still believe he's the Son of God. I still believe he died for me, all those things. But my church actually talks about that, whereas the church I grew up in talks about all these fringe topics, right? It was where they put the emphasis that turned it from orthodoxy to cultish inculcation.
Yeah. And that's a big part of it with a lot of these cultish kind of churches or cults is that there's a lot of proof texting and there's a lot of sort of extra biblical requirements to be in the fold, right? And everybody, even though, I mean, I don't know if they actually say this at IFB churches, but from reading your book, it sounds like if you're not in an IFB church, you're pretty much the lost. Like you can be in a church that has Orthodox Christian doctrine, but you're basically lost. We're the only ones going to heaven. I mean, is that accurate?
To tell you how far right we were in our religion, I remember the guy who lived next door to me in college my freshman year, his girlfriend transferred from Liberty University, so Falwellville. And this is Liberty in 1990-something, right? Not now. And the joke that they played on people on our campus, they're like, oh, what brought you here? And she said, I got saved. And everyone believed her.
Wow.
Because we thought Falwell and Liberty was this liberal bastion. My senior year of college, we did videos about how liberal Bob Jones University was. We were required to sit in these, oh my gosh. And I remember the last one, it was our last senior class meeting. Normally that's like a retrospective. You show pictures and videos from your time at college and here's the fun things we did. And they sat us down and they showed us this video about how Bob Jones had gone liberal. And like laughter and moans erupted from us seniors, and the administration were standing around the outside of the room and they're looking at each other like, oh no, like we didn't mean this to be funny. You know, they were shocked that like we have done everything we could for the last 4 years to indoctrinate them in this stuff and it's not taking. It's just crazy.
Man, I knew somebody that went to Bob Jones, and she showed me, I mean, it was shocking to me. She showed me this thick handbook that they had with all of the, I mean, the requirements. I mean, even like when you got out of bed, there was something about a certain way you get out of bed and you have to put both feet on the floor or something. It was just the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I got in trouble one night because I was talking to my roommate in the dark. So we had someone come around, turn our lights off. We're grown adults. I was about to get married. And they would come and make sure our lights are off. When they would check, we couldn't have locks on the door because they had to be able to do instant inspections 24 hours a day. To look for music, to check under our mattress for whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my roommate in the top bunk, and I stood up rather than sit in my bunk. And when the floor leader opened the door, the light from the hallway showed that I was not physically under the covers of my bed, and I got in trouble. It's that authoritarian. And then what they were told, those floor leaders, so they were abused because they would go to meetings, and the administration of the college would use the verse that says, if a man knows to do right and does it not, to him it is sin. And so what they told those floor leaders, the narcs, was, if you don't turn people in, you can't have a clean conscience. The line they used to use to them is, you can't put your head on your pillow at night with a clean conscience if you're not writing people up. And so they turned everybody, you just didn't trust anybody.
Yeah. And honestly, this is a false gospel. This is basically saying salvation by works, not by grace. I mean, that's the heart of legalism. We've touched on how that the pastor was kind of this demagogue, right? He could do whatever he wanted. And you also talk about there was kind of a caste system as well within IFB. I've never heard anybody describe it that way, but it certainly gets the point across. Mm. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, men were in a higher caste than women.
Of course.
That's obvious. But there was like certain tiers that you could be. And once you got to certain tiers, you were unassailable by anybody in a tier below it. Obviously, the number one was if you were a martyr. So, you know, if you were a believer in a church underground in China or Afghanistan or whatever, you know, that's a level. Then you had missionaries. There was like certain ones. And they used to tell us over and over again about, you want to be the top ones. We want to switch you as much as possible. And it's so funny because our college had like 55 majors, but their goal was to flip everybody to ministerial. We used to have a missions conference every few years. And they would do these huge, long, I'm talking like 25-minute altar calls to get people to change their majors to become missions majors. Or the head of my department. So I graduated with a degree in writing with minors in graphic design and advertising. And the head of my department, I was talking to him one day about job placement. And I had a really cherry gig and I ended up getting it out of college. But before that, he goes, our goal is not for you to work in the secular workforce. We want you to go to work for a mission board or a church or whatever as a writer or designer. Because that's your highest calling. And I was like, have you looked in advertising? Have you looked in journalism? It's like, there's some really godless places out there. Like if I went to work for Vanity Fair or Rolling Stone or whatever, I'm sure it wouldn't take much light to be a light in the darkness there. And so they had this idea that you are only close to God if you are doing something like that. Like if you were in what they called full-time ministry, they had this phrase, and pastors would come in and preach to us, you know, four times a week, whatever, three times a week. And they would say, hey, whatever God's called you, whether you're a missionary, a pastor, a Christian school teacher, sometimes they would throw in nurse because that was considered noble. And then they just said, or whatever you might be. And I was always a whatever you might be. You can start to feel like a second class citizen, which again, then the people in power use against them. So when they abuse somebody, they're like, well, you can't assail the man of God from your caste. Now they wouldn't use that word, but they're like, who are you? You know, there was one pastor out in your neck of the woods, out in Illinois, who used to make people in lower caste do pushups on the platform during the service. Like, drop down right now and give me 17 pushups. Just to show, hey, I am higher up. I am closer to God. I have more power. I have a bigger sword that I pull out. So however you want to say it. And so it's just indoctrinated into us in all these small ways.
And that's so anti-gospel. It's so anti what Jesus stood for. I mean, he came for the least of these and he cared about the least of these. And he said that we all have to be like children, which children, you know, in that culture, in most cultures, are like nothing, right? I mean, they have no standing at all. And it's just so sad to hear things like that, which are just antithesis of what the gospel is all about. And it's not surprising that as you became an adult and you're attending these IFB churches, it sounds like spiritually it just wasn't doing it for you. And you were, you began to struggle. Talk about kind of like your spiritual journey to a really a much more authentic faith than you ever had growing up.
So it started by marrying an amazing woman. So my wife did not grow up in the fundamentalist movement. She grew up on the mission field. Her dad, when Jim Elliot was martyred on the field, he signed up to go to the tribe across the river from them. So my wife has pictures of them growing up where they're the only people with clothes. Like it was that that tribal. And so her parents, because they're missionaries, they had just heard about our college and said, well, she'll be safe there. And they sent her there. And she just didn't thrive there at all, because you can imagine going from the mission field to that. So then when we got married, we're in IFB church, it just was horrible for her. It didn't really bother me because it was the water I've been swimming in. So when we moved back to the East Coast to take my job here in Virginia, I told her, I said, here's the deal. I owe you. I'm going to give you the deciding vote at our next church. And so she chose.
And that's pretty radical for an IFB guy, yeah, right? Like you're the head of the home, man. You're
but I also wanted a wife who wanted to be intimate with me, right? I also wanted a wife who was happy and would make me the meals I wanted, right? So it's kind of the happy wife, happy life thing. But yeah, it was a departure definitely from my parents. And she chose a Spanish speaking church, and I don't speak much Spanish. But what that broke in me is we had people from 14 different countries in this little church. And seeing subcultures and how they worship. And in my mind, I go, oh, of course they do church differently because that's Venezuelan or that's Guatemalan or that's whatever. And that was a crack going, wait a second. So church can be different from different cultures. What was the culture I was in? Right. So then several years later, we transitioned to the church where she's now on staff and where I serve on Sundays. And there was this pragmatic approach to faith that I'd never seen before. I came every Sunday trying to prove this church wrong. I really did. I'd heard about it. My brother-in-law invited me and I get there. And what's interesting is, so the pastor there has a doctorate in master's in experiential education and a doctorate in ethnography, where he would study subcultures and say, how do we make the gospel appropriate to that subculture? And then in his master's work, he was a wilderness guide. And he says, how do we take extreme experiences and form life takeaways from them? And I'm wired for outdoors. I started doing trips. My first trip with him was to Patagonia. And then we started going all over the world, hiking some of the most iconic trails.
I'm a huge hiker.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I started with Fitzroy.
Yeah. I'm about to head to Arizona right now. And I'm just like, very excited.
Yeah, get there now before it gets too hot.
Yeah, that's
right. But anyway, so one of the things, so he worked with an outfit called Outward Bound and others. But one of the things they would ask you at the end was they'd say, okay, you just did something you didn't think you could do. Or you didn't think you'd ever do, you didn't have the capacity for it. And what you found is that line is arbitrary. What's something back home you can do that right now you don't think is possible to do? And so he brought that framework into the faith space, made it very pragmatic. And I walked into an environment, they invited us there to ask questions, you know, and I remember my little small group, the couple there was going through infertility at the time. And they said, we're having a hard time believing that God is good because he won't give us kids. And I'd never heard anybody be that authentic with their pain in a church environment, let alone they were our small group leaders. And so we just stopped everything and prayed over them. And so it set the bar really high that when I have questions or when I have pain or church is uncomfortable for me or I don't know what to do, that I can actually say it and that it will be held with grace and love and responded that way. And so then I just dove into it head over heels because like this is the safest place for me. And then 10 years ago, one of my friends was going through a really hard season of his life, and I started an outdoor Bible study, is basically what it was, a book study and prayer time. And it's now we got guys from like 4 to 6 different churches depending on the night, and we just sit around a fire and read the Bible and say, hey, what do you see out of this? What could I learn from you? And we pray fervent prayers over each other and dare each other to do great things, go do service projects together. And so having that safe community of people of 3 different generations at a time, where my questions are allowed and where people love Jesus like the disciples love Jesus. Like I look at it and the people around me look like the people I read about in the Gospels. And I was like, I just want to be more like them. One of the guys in my circle I just look up to so much, he left the Amish faith, then he left the Mennonite faith, and then he went to our church now. And so he's 70 some years old, and he's said, I've changed my faith multiple times, and here's why. This is what I learned about God, you know, and to have people around you like that, I don't know, it's an accelerant for your faith and your growth and your reconstruction, because you go, that's the real thing.
And it sounds like you connected with Jesus in a way. I mean, I would think coming from what you came from, that God would pretty much be a taskmaster who just wants you to do things. But it sounds like it became, like you would talk about, it's not a religion, it's a relationship, but it really wasn't a relationship. Talk about that, how this, you know, your view of God probably had to change, right?
Yes. And I'm sorry that I can't remember the author that I heard this, but she's doing a study and she's found that you can tell what type of parent a new believer has by who they pray to, whether they pray to the Father, whether they pray to Jesus, or whether they pray to the Holy Spirit. It's a really fascinating framework. Mm. And what I noticed after I heard that was I always prayed to Jesus. I never prayed to the Father. I never said, you know, and so, which makes sense, right? Like if I'm scared of my dad, maybe I'm scared of my Heavenly Father. And so that gave me framework to then go back to mentors of mine to talk about it. It gave me framework to talk to my therapist to go, why am I so scared of God? And so what has happened is I am more in love with Jesus of Nazareth than I've ever been. And so I can look at it that way. And that also narrows the Bible, right? If you have a hard time with the God of the Old Testament or God of some of these weird stories in the Bible, you say, but I can follow that Jesus guy. We can figure out the rest of the Bible later. And you can, right? Then you use the filter of Jesus to go read everything else. But falling in love with Jesus first and most was the impetus for it all.
It's interesting. I'm thinking back in my 20s was probably, and I grew up, I became a believer very young. It was real to me. I loved Jesus, you know, as far back as I can remember, but I never understood grace. It was kind of like I was, and this is embarrassing to admit, but, you know, I was a good kid and, you know, God was kind of lucky to have one like me, you know, I mean, literally it was that bad. And, which now is like so embarrassing to admit. But understanding how sinful I was before a holy God and his grace that extends to me and all that. I mean, that was just huge for me. And I'm sure it was preached in my church growing up, but I just didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And when I did, it was so huge to me that even though I'd been a believer, you know, for the first, you know, 20 some years of my life, I felt like I was almost becoming a Christian, you know, because it was such a different experience with the Lord. I'm curious for you, like, do you feel like you were a Christian that whole time before, like as a kid? Do you feel like you became one? And I'm not even sure that these designations are important, you know, because I think we like to have like a time, right? And it's a relationship. It grows and you like get to know him. And so you love the Jesus you know, but then as you know him more, you fall more in love. But I'm just curious how you kind of, and maybe that's just an unbelievably evangelical question I just asked.
Right? No, that's interesting. I have thought about it a couple of times, but I don't think about it regularly. I don't know. I know what I have now is real. I've been baptized into three different faiths. So I started out, I was christened a Catholic. Then I was dunked into the IFB when I was 4 or 5. And then,
because your dad was Catholic before he became IFB.
My mom was Lutheran and they fought over which one I would be. And my dad won that one too. And then my mom actually joined the IFB before my dad, and then my dad came along. I know what I have now is real. I have to go. There are so many people in the New Testament particularly, and even in the Old Testament, where it says faith was attributed to them, or your sins have been forgiven, or today you'll be in paradise. And they didn't follow any particular thing. You know, one of the things we've been learning, we're going through the book of Mark in my Bible study, is how much of a knucklehead the disciples were. Like, it's right in front of them. They still couldn't figure it out, which gives me grace. So maybe I just, it was the best I knew how at that time.
Yeah.
What I know is that what I have now is the realest thing that I've ever experienced. It's the most intimate encounters. I don't remember crying, talking to Jesus growing up, right? I don't remember, not in an intimate way anyway. I don't remember having these moments where I felt utterly seen and loved and understood and recognize on a soul level like I do now. I'll give you a short example. This sounds kind of mystical, but so I've been to all 7 continents, both polar circles. I love adrenaline and adventure. And several Thanksgivings ago, it was right after our daughter came to live with us, but before we'd gone through the process to become parents, everything was up in the air. We were learning stuff about my dad. All this was going on. My business was changing. I went to Iceland in the wintertime, and it was nighttime. It was black sky, black sand, black water, mm-hmm. no clouds in the sky, no moon, black everything. And I'm listening to worship music, just crying. I was like, God, this is my life back home. I don't know how to make sense. I don't know which direction is which. I don't know anything. That was a Tuesday night. I fly home that next weekend at church. It just so happened our video guys didn't know where I was, anything. I was standing on a very specific beach. It's Vic Beach, V-I-K, has very specific rocks. Like, it's known for what the rocks look like. Mm-hmm. And the video behind our lyrics as we're singing was from Vic Beach. And the lyrics were about how God knew our pain and loved us. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, he took me to this beach 4 days before. And I don't know that video has been played a whole lot in the background since. Mm-hmm. But in a space of 4 days, God's like, yeah, I see you. I know you don't know, but I have the map. I have the globe. I know. And I know your heart. I know the recesses in the corners of your heart. And I'm going to go with you. And it's not that he gave me any answers. I just knew he's going to be with me. And a few months after that, everything got locked down for COVID. everything changed in my life. Everything was, and I knew, no, God is with me. He was there in the dark. He'll be there in the daytime. And so I don't know. I don't know that I ever had any intimate encounters like that with Jesus growing up.
It's very, very moving story. Thank you for telling that. Wow. And I'm thinking of a ton of stories that I can't go into right now, but but I think if you know Jesus long enough and you have those just like those moments that just mark you for the rest of your life. And I know one of those for me happened 35 years ago, maybe 40. Mm. Yeah, it was probably 40 years. Yeah. Mm. And I still can't tell that story without choking up because it's still as real as it was back then. So
that's beautiful.
Well, that was such a powerful story. And it's so cool to hear about ways that God spoke in such a personal and moving way in Ryan's life. And in part two of this podcast, you'll hear more about ways that God redeemed areas of Ryan's life. He also explains more about why he believes the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Church is a cult. He talks about the propaganda pastors use to justify their misogyny and legalism. And he reveals some scary ideas common within IFB churches when it comes to politics and violence.
And so you have IFE pastors after Joe Biden was elected getting up and saying, hey, I don't know if this is right, but I'm not going to get in the way of God if his will is to assassinate Joe Biden from the pulpit. And you go, wait, what? Like, where did Jesus ever call us to assassinate our enemy? When Peter cut the guard's ear off, Jesus healed the guard and then said to Peter, like, what are you doing, man? Like, this isn't how we do this.
So there's some pretty crazy stuff that Ryan reveals in part two of our podcast, so be watching for that. Also, I want to remind you that we're giving Ryan's book away to anyone who gives a gift of $30 or more to the Roy's Report this month. So if you'd like to support our work and get this fantastic resource, just go to julieroys, spelled roys.com/donate. That's julieroys.com/donate. Also, just a quick reminder to subscribe to The Roy's Report on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. That way, you won't miss any of these episodes. And while you're at it, I'd really appreciate it if you'd help us spread the word about the podcast by leaving a review. And then, please share the podcast on social media so more people can hear about this great content. Again, thanks so much for joining me today. Hope you were blessed and encouraged.